To be misunderstood in this life is inevitable. It's part of life. We say one thing, it's taken another way, we didn't mean it that way, and it causes offense. It's not so good. As Chuck Swindoll in his commentary points out, the Bible is full of people who were misunderstood, and you can think of some others as I mention these. Noah, the ark builder. He was a crazy boat builder. In dry land, he built an ark big enough for 5 houses. David, whom Saul thought was overambitious, utterly, completely, and totally misunderstood about his loyalty to Saul. And one of the most might be Joseph in the book of Genesis, whose brothers misinterpreted nearly everything he said and did. Everything he tried to explain, he was misunderstood, and it caused tremendous sadness. As we proceed, and we'll pick up Acts chapter 21 again, as we proceed through Acts chapter 21, we'll find that Paul and his team finally wind themselves up in Jerusalem. He's talked about it for 2 or 3 chapters, but something very quickly in this chapter goes amiss, tragically. Luke tells us a very strange series of events, totally unexpected, overshadowing the reasons for the trip to the city of Jerusalem in the first place. Paul is often misunderstood, but here in chapter 21, among all the chapters, at the end of his third and final missionary journey, is his greatest test. Lest I be misunderstood, we continue with Acts, completing one of the craziest, I don't know any other word, and maybe you won't agree with that identification of it, one of the most crazy, but one of the most interesting chapters. It's not even the whole chapter, we're just completing chapter 21. We've entitled it Acts chapter 21, part 2, Paul and the Law, Just a Misunderstanding. So turn with me, if you would, to Acts chapter 21. We're going to pick it up in verse 15. And after those days, we packed and went up to Jerusalem. Remember the phrase, up to Jerusalem is usually meaning in location and also possibly for other reasons when you go up to Jerusalem. Also, some of the disciples from Caesarea went with us and brought with them a certain Manassan of Cyprus, an early disciple with whom we were there to lodge. You'll notice the word us, this is one of the few chapters in the last part of Acts where Luke uses this phrase, us, meaning he as well as the others with him. And when we had come to Jerusalem, the brethren received us gladly. On the following day, Paul went with us to James, and all the elders were present. When he had greeted them, he told in detail those things which God had done among the Gentiles through his ministry. And when they heard it, they glorified the Lord. And they said to him, "You see, brother, how many myriads, thousands of Jews who are among the Gentiles. You see, brother, how many myriads of Jews are there who have believed, and they are all zealous for the law." So far, so good. Backslapping, warm greetings, everything great, exchange of news, the growth in the church, both among the Jews, now believing, and Gentiles. Paul speaks of the conversions of the Greeks or Gentiles to believing in Jesus Christ. James and the elders talk of thousands of Jews. They also now believe, as Jews, in Jesus Christ. But the end of verse 20, there's this qualifier. They are all zealous for the law. The nomos. They are all zealous for the law. We would expect that of Jews, to be zealous for the law. But it raises our antennae, and well, it should. Because what we see in the next verse, before we get to verse 21, what has Luke not mentioned at all? He has bypassed 2 subjects in particular and not discussed them. Number one is Paul's desire to be in Jerusalem, which he states in chapter 18, verse 21, and chapter 20, verse 16. "I must by all means keep this feast in Jerusalem." He's speaking of Pentecost. "I must be in Jerusalem by Pentecost," the high day. And also, that's point one, also the collection that they had taken up for the saints in Jerusalem. Neither subject is addressed for the rest of this chapter because Luke is obviously overtaken by what happened during this chapter's verses. So his desire to be in Jerusalem for Pentecost is not mentioned, nor is the collection for Jerusalem saints. Nothing. Nada. Zilch. The other issue is the word law. We've discussed this nuance before. It's important. Law can mean a number of things to a Jew of the first century, as it can today. The book that Mr. Garnett was told not to touch is this book, the Mishnah. Then there's this book, half of it, that you have in your lap or on your phone. the law that is written in the Torah. The law can mean two different things to those people. Torah means the five books of Moses. The oral Torah, which is a very important subject, later became the written Mishnah. This is just the Mishnah, an abridged version, by the way. They sell it by the pound. It has 63 tractates or categories. One is Netzir, tractate Netzir, in both the Mishnah and later in the Talmud in 400 CE. I want you to recall this later because we're going to press on. Verse 21 begins with a very famous but. Verse 21, let me move the lights here. Yeah, sorry. Verse 21, they're zealous for the law, verse 21, but. They have been informed about you, Paul, that you teach all the Jews who are among the Gentiles to forsake Moses, saying that they ought not to circumcise their children or to walk according to their customs. What then? The assembly must certainly meet. People will hear about it. They'll come together. They'll hear that you have come. Therefore, do what we tell you. We have four men who have taken a vow. Take them and be purified with them. Pay their expenses so that they may shave their heads, and that all may know that those things of which they were informed concerning you are nada, are nothing, but that you yourself also walk orderly and keep the law. But concerning the Gentiles who believe, we have written and decided that they should observe no such thing, remember that phrase, except that they should keep themselves from things offered to idols, from blood, from things strangled, and from sexual immorality. Wow. Wow. This is the crux of the chapter. There is so much here. Paul has been accused of forsaking the Mosaic law. Now, is he accused of forsaking the written or the oral? We're not told. More than likely, he has been accused of forsaking the written law. The oral law was just that at that time in the first century. It was oral. It had not been written down. It is now written down. But then it was still oral. More than likely, he is accused of violating Mosaic law that is written. The written Torah, we call it. And this is an important distinction. But they have a solution. As we will see, is very interesting. Verse 21, they tell him, we have been informed about you, Paul. The question we would ask, by whom? How was this told? What exactly was said, other than you forsake the Torah of Moses, the law of Moses? Who told you this? What is their proof? I paraphrase, now we don't believe it, Paul. That's not stated. I wonder if they did. We're not told. We don't believe it because the word customs is another key word here. And the word customs in the Greek is where we get the word ethics. The ethos of the law, the carrying out, the actual ethics, and the traditions of the Jews. It can mean both either the oral or the written law. Do you remember, it was referenced, I think, a couple of Sabbaths ago in a message, a movie known as Fiddler on the Roof. What does it begin with and end with? What word does it begin with and end with on Fiddler on the Roof? Tradition. The traditions they're talking about invariably in modern times is this baby, the 63 tractates. Tradition. The word in verse 23, the word vow is used, an interesting word. This is probably the Nazarite vow that he's speaking of, the shaving of the head from number 6. Vows are an important part of God's law. Vows are mentioned throughout the Old Testament and even the Psalms and Proverbs. Psalms 56 and 61 and a host of others reference vows. We sing them in our hymnal. Look at them. Look for them next time you sing in a verse. You'll see that I pay my vows. Or my vows to you, O God. What is a vow? A vow is basically a formal promise. We make promises to God all the time that we will do this or that. And there's nothing wrong with that. But a vow is binding, just as a promise is binding. Nazarite vows were prominent and common. Turn with me, if you would. Hold your hand in Acts chapter 21. We're going to go back to, but turn with me, if you would, to Numbers chapter 6. We won't read all of it. Numbers chapter 6, beginning in verse 1. Then the Eternal spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when either, interesting, a man or woman consecrates an offering to take the vow of a Nazarite, to separate himself to the Lord or herself. He shall separate herself or himself from wine and similar drink. He shall drink neither vinegar made from wine nor vinegar made from similar drink. Neither shall he drink any grape juice, nor eat fresh grapes or raisins. All the days of his separation he shall eat nothing that is produced by the grapevine from seed to skin. There's a whole theology behind that of why. It's fascinating, but that's not our point today. Drop down to verse 9. And if anyone dies very suddenly beside him, next to the Nazarite, and he defiles his consecrated head, then he shall shave his head on the day of his cleansing. On the seventh day he shall shave it. Then on the eighth day he shall bring two turtle doves or two young pigeons to the priest, to the door of the tabernacle of meeting. And you can read the rest of Numbers chapter 6. There's not a whole lot more than what I've read. But the time period is 7 to 8 days, and it has to do with the shaving of the head and the abstinence of things from the grape. Turn back with me to Acts chapter 21. This is important for the background of the Nazarite vow. What's interesting, and I invite you to pick up any commentary, they seem, either Catholic or Protestant, they seem utterly confused about number 6. We just read it. It's only a few, how many verses is it? 20, 24 verses? They seem utterly confused about what is in issue here. They're confused for the 7-8 days in the oral law. Our old friend the Mishnah has an entire chapter, a long one nonetheless, on Nazarites. And that's important. Remember, the Mishnah was redacted and written down in approximately 200, 300 CE. Let me take the next 90 minutes or so to read the section of the Nazarite vows. I see shaking of head. I see rebellion. No, I'm not going to do it. I wouldn't do that to you because it'd take longer than 90 minutes. But I will read from the Steinsaltz edition of the Talmud. It's this Mishnah Netzir. For those who want to look at it, Google this. This is so easy to do. M-N-A-Z-I-R 6.3 in the Steinsaltz Talmud edition. This is the Mishnah. A Nazariteship of unspecified length lasts for 30 days. If a Nazarite shaved his hair during that time, or if he is shaved by bandits, I'm just reading it, against his will, this negates the 30 days of his Nazariteship, which he must account afresh, start all over. With regard to a Nazarite who shaved his hair, whether he did so with scissors or with a razor, or if he pulled it out at any amount, he is liable, and he starts over. I'll stop there. This is the Gemara, the commentary on the Mishnah. This is in addition to what is written in the Mishnah that formed the Talmud. The Gemara states, a dilemma was raised before the sages, the rabbis. Does this hair that grow on the body, I'm going to kid you not, I'm reading it word for word, does this hair that grows on the body grow from the bottom or from the top? Which part of the hair is new? These are heavy questions. The Gemara explains, what is the difference between these possibilities? The Gemara answers, it is relevant for the case of a Nazarite who was shaved by bandits or shaved himself, but his head was not entirely shaved, whether they left part of it. It goes on and on and on and on. Why is this important? It is incredibly important, and it is not the folk pun in the first speaker. We have a tendency, the Garnets do, of sarcasm. It's the lowest form of wit. I respond, at least it's still wit. But we don't mean to poke fun or ridicule the book at all, because it is extremely important. But it exhibits the difference between the written law, which you hold in your lap, and the oral traditions, the expansion of the law of Moses. And we can recall that Judaism today considers this book, now not all of this book, half of this book, this book, as equal. And in some cases of Orthodox Judaism, it's this. That's how important this is. The fact that the commentaries, the Protestant and Catholic commentaries, are troubled by the difference in these two is alarming. Very, very not understandable. Torah customs, as we'll see Paul do, Torah customs, while the temple still stood, were understandable. But I personally, and I'll be honest with you, I am concerned when I hear speakers quote the oral Torah, the Mishnah, as somehow it is a guide to our worship. It is not. It is much like Josephus. It is a historical reference and nothing more. In my humble opinion, the Mishnah and Talmud are fascinating books. They are wonderful. They can shed light on some of the practices that we see in the New Testament. But it is blatantly obvious when it does not accord with biblical law, and when it does. And when it does not is the majority of the writings. Jesus said, complete the phrase for me if you would. Jesus said, teaching for doctrines the... That's right, Matthew 15, very good. This is what he was talking about. It's okay to touch it, by the way. There's no harm in it. Verse 24 brings up a fascinating subject about shaving of the heads. This was an outward form, back in Acts chapter 21. This was an outward form and an interesting part of the Nazarite vow. In the last few years, you probably have noticed that people will shave their heads as a sign of solidarity with cancer patients. It's very common. Social media, how many have seen it on social media? Yeah, three quarters of the room has. It's all over. And I know of at least 10 videos I've seen where barbers have been asked to clean up a cancer victim, a person who's going through chemotherapy, to shave their head, then they shave theirs. It's a sign of solidarity. The chemo often causes temporary baldness. Verse 25 is interesting. Verse 25, I'm going to ask you another question. But concerning the Gentiles who believe, these are believing Gentiles in Jesus Christ, they believe, we have written and decided that they should observe no such thing. How many of you have that in your Bible? Very few of you. Of those that have it in their Bible, how many have an asterisk by it? All of you should have an asterisk by it. Do you know why that asterisk is there? It doesn't appear in the oldest manuscripts. In my Bible, this has an asterisk and it's somewhat italicized. They should observe no such thing is not a part of the majority of manuscripts. So let's read it as it is in the older manuscripts. We have written and decided, except that they should keep themselves from things offered to idols, from blood, from things strangled, and from sexual immorality. This harkens back to Acts 15, if you remember the Acts 15 decree. They said, for the time being, in fact, let's turn there if you would, Acts chapter 15, verse 18. Keep in mind that the Acts 15 decree, as it's called, to Protestant and Catholic theologians, this was the site, this was the place of the break. They did not have to keep the law because of Acts 15. Let's read it in context, beginning in verse 18. Known to God from eternity, all his words, whoops, yeah, from all his words, we should not trouble these from among the Gentiles who are turning to God, but that we write to them to abstain from things polluted by idols, from sexual immorality, from things strangled, and from blood. Verse 21, for Moses has had throughout many generations those who preach him in every city being read in the synagogues every Sabbath. Where would the Gentiles be on Saturday? They would be in a synagogue observing the Sabbath. Where who would be read? Then as today, Moses. They will learn about the law Sabbath by Sabbath. It also says this is surely a minimal requirement to do these things because this was prominent among the Gentiles. It was not to be for all time. If it was, then I guess murder, lying, idolatry are all acceptable? They weren't mentioned. No, this was meant to be a temporary thing for beginning with Gentiles. But they would be hearing Moses every Sabbath day in the synagogue, in church, as it were. Turn back with me to Acts chapter 21. What would be Paul's response? Acts chapter 21, verse 26. Then Paul, how would he respond to what they've asked him to do? The charges were false. The charges were false about Paul. How would he respond? Then Paul took the men, and the next day, having been purified with them, entered the temple to announce the expiration of the days of preparation, purification, exactly out of number 6, at which time an offering should be made for each one of them. Isn't that fascinating? Again, you might, after the Sabbath, or when you're home, just read Numbers chapter 6, because it is really informative. So Paul takes charge. In verse 27, we'll continue. Now, when the 7 days were almost ended, the Jews from Asia, seeing him in the temple, stirred up the whole crowd and laid hands on him, crying out, "Men of Israel, help! This is the man." Can you just picture this in your mind's eye, then pointing at Paul? This is the guy. This guy right here. This is the man who teaches all men, everybody, everywhere, against the people, the law, and this place. And furthermore, he has also brought Greeks into the temple and has defiled this holy place. For they had previously seen Trophimus, the Ephesian, with him in the city, whom they supposed, there's that word, they supposed that Paul had brought into the temple. So Paul indeed agrees to take charge. Notice that 7 days and 8 days are mentioned, exactly in accordance with number 6. No deviance there whatsoever. Not according to the oral traditions. He goes on, verse 30. And all the city was disturbed, and the people ran together. This is going to be reminiscent, if you remember. Does anybody remember where the other two riots were? Ephesus and Thessalonica. And they had parallels in both cases. Watch what happens. This is Ephesus all over again. The city was disturbed, and the people ran together, seized Paul, and dragged him, verse 30, out of the temple. And immediately the doors of the temple were shut. Now, as they were seeking to kill him, Paul, news came to the commander of the garrison that all Jerusalem was in an uproar. This is the Roman legate at the time, and it was a Roman province. They had jurisdiction. Anything went south, the Romans felt they had to take charge. And here we find once again a Gentile government official, as we'll see, rescuing Paul. He immediately, verse 32, he immediately took soldiers and centurions and ran down to them. And when they saw the commander and the soldiers, they stopped beating Paul. Roman shows up, they stopped beating Paul. Then the commander came near and took him, commanded him to be bound with two chains, and he asked him who he was and what he had done. Who are you and what have you done? And some among the multitude cried one thing and another. So he, the commander, could not ascertain the truth because of the tumult. He commanded him, Paul, to be taken back into the barracks. When he reached the stairs, he had to be carried by the soldiers because of the violence of the mob. Can you just picture this? This is crazy. For the multitude of the people followed after, crying, "Away with him, away with him." Now that phrase is interesting. Away with him has to do, where else do we hear the phrase, "Away with him, away with him"? John 19 in the book of Mark. It has to do with Jesus when they said to take him away with him, and they crucified him. So it has the connotation of, as a powerful phrase, possibly leading to death. What's also interesting is that Paul is accused of speaking against the people, the law, and the temple. Five things. These three, plus bringing a Gentile and defiling the temple, all lies. All of them lies. We go on. Verse 37. Then as Paul was about to be led into the barracks, he said to the commander, "May I speak to you?" Now, this exchange is very interesting, so we're going to read this a little slowly because it has some detail that we want to emphasize. He said to the commander, the Roman, "May I speak to you?" He replied, "Can you speak Greek?" Here's a Roman official who speaks obviously Latin, at least, and possibly Greek. "Can you speak Greek?" Why did Paul speak to a Roman commander in Greek? That's another question. "Are you not the Egyptian who some time ago stirred up a rebellion and led 4,000 assassins out into the wilderness?" So he's getting his historical events confused, and he thinks, the Roman commander thinks, and there was indeed an Egyptian who did cause a ruckus. Verse 39, the lights give me a little bit of trouble. Verse 39, "But Paul said, 'I am a Jew from Tarsus, in Cilicia, a citizen of no mean city, and I implore you, permit me to speak to the people.'" Paul, if anything, has got guts. I would love to know if he was speaking all of this in Greek, Latin, or what. Verse 40, "So when he," had given him permission, when the Roman had given Paul permission, Paul stood on the stairs and motioned with the hand to the people. Can you just picture Paul standing on the stairs, raising? It's very common in the book of Acts, as you remember. It's used quite often. He raises his hand on the stairs and with his hand to the people, and when there was a great silence, they calmed down. He spoke to them, not in Greek, not in Latin, but in the Hebrew language, saying. The Hebrew language, the word there, language, is very interesting. It is the word dialectos, where we get the word dialect. So a dialect of Hebrew in this case, they think of it as probably Aramaic. So Paul spoke these languages, as many of them did. It's very interesting. So he's about ready to speak to them in verse chapter 22, verse 1. Brethren and fathers, hear my defense. We heard last Sabbath, the word defense. We know the word is apologia. The whole study of a defense of the position of your faith is known as apologetics. Let me tell you my defense before you now. And we will end it there. We'll save it for next time, where Paul defends his beliefs and practice. And let's conclude. We have learned at least four things here in this short set of verses. The entire section, the tumult, the confusion, the anger, the hostility, the beatings, having the rescue by a Roman commander, all of it started on false claims leading to a simple, sad misunderstanding. All of it. Misunderstandings can be relatively light and harmless, or they can be major, as we have here. You can't get much more major than misunderstandings resulting in death, or potential death. How could this have been avoided? How could have they gotten past this? James and the elders were faithful people, but they were not and are not perfect. They're sinful people just like you and I. They got it wrong. They believed something that was untrue, and they asked Paul to prove it. Neither was Paul. Paul was not perfect either. But this happens among Christians. Paul and his group, and James and the elders in Jerusalem. In Chuck Swindoll's commentary, he says, quote, "Church is one of Satan's favorite seeds for growing a weedy crop of misunderstandings, he tells through our thoughts like soil, mixing in a shovel full of good intentions and a bag full of prejudice and a few pellets of pride. Then he scatters and accusing here and there, inflammatory comment there, and he waits for them to germinate." We've all been subject to misunderstandings. Well, let's first look at how Paul reacted to what happened. How did he react to this? Paul took the high ground. He didn't question their claims. He didn't argue with them. He didn't fight for his defense at that point, that these are all false. What you've heard about me is wrong. He acquiesced immediately. He knew the claims were false. He really had nothing to prove, did he? He knew down deep inside that they were false. He did keep God's law. Still, when he was aware of the misunderstanding, he took immediate action based upon their request. He was caring and he was serving, or he attempted to be. He looked at the objective. He tried to prove through his actions, though he did not need to, that he didn't keep the written law of God. What's interesting in this whole exercise is we don't see, or Luke doesn't tell us, Paul praying about it. I would imagine he prayed furiously. Would you? I would. That this would come to a right conclusion. We could easily guess that he did. But there are steps to be learned here, I think, because it is eventually about misunderstanding this section. The entire section was built on a sad, simple misunderstanding, a believing a false report. So, if you hear things that don't seem right, don't make sense about someone, number one, don't believe everything you hear. The web and the internet should be proof enough of that. It's more lies and deceit than it is truth. But even on a person-to-person basis, don't believe everything you hear. Number two, so important, I am so sensitive to this, don't spread it. Don't ever, ever spread it. If you're in doubt, don't spread it. Even if you think there's some truth in it, do not repeat it. That is how it is spread. Be factual, not emotional. As we see, Paul was very factual. It's easy to say but hard to do, but we need to make sure that we are on the right side when we hear these things. Second of all, if it's about you, how many of you have ever been misunderstood? Yeah, the rest of you don't want to raise your hand. All of us have, but to one degree or another, we've all had this happen. But if it's about you, as it was with Paul, Ralph Waldo Emerson said, to be great is to be misunderstood. We cited a number of biblical examples of men, and there's many, many more in the Bible that were misunderstood. To be great is to be misunderstood. The Bible agrees. Another writer, Albert Hubbard, added, it is no proof of greatness to be misunderstood. The final proof of greatness lies in being able to endure it without resentment. To endure it without resentment. Again, when things are said about you or of others that you know and love and care about, it's hard to endure it, but that's what needs to be done. Our reaction to criticism, unfounded criticism, misunderstandings that build and that always will build and display our character of what we really believe down deep inside. And note here in these verses that we've read of chapter 21, and we'll read in chapter 22, that God will use this as he does through Paul, and he can in your life and mine. God can use it, the misunderstanding, for good.